That for the end of the lecture, if I win it. Actually, Richard, I thought I was going to give a talk on the birds and the bees, not a string theory. A string theory, okay. I'll try to make something up. So let me, well, start by saying welcoming you to PI. I mean, you've been here already for 1 week, but I guess I didn't have a chance to interact with you earlier. And essentially, what I want to talk a little bit about from a very lowbrow point of view is what are the basic ideas and ambitions of string theory. And the way Richard set up the presentation, the title of the presentation was called What is String Theory? And at some level, at some fundamental level, if you want to think as being a rigorous scientist, the answer to this question is that we don't know what string theory fundamentally is. And that's why it's a lot of fun to work on it. Essentially, what we know from string theory is just bits and pieces of some very deep fundamental theory that hopefully has something to do with nature, but we don't have a global picture of what this theory is. It is a little bit like, you know, finding in the ground pieces of a fossil, and you understand that piece and that piece, but you don't know which animal you actually discovered. So we understand very deeply some aspects of this beast, but not the whole picture. In some sense, string theory, in order to really formulate it and understand what it really is, we will require finding new principles, new mathematical framework, a new language to describe that theory. Just like general relativity required a new principle to explain gravity, like the equivalence principle, string theory has not yet found what's at the heart of the theory that will give us the new principles from which we will be able to derive everything. Okay? So I'll start from very basic. And in a nutshell, if you wish, a slogan that you could put on a t-shirt because it's too long, about what is string theory is an attempt to provide a unified description of all elementary forces in nature. So the key words here are unification and elementary forces, and of course nature. Okay. So right now, as you've been seeing in the last few weeks, there are several theories that work extremely well at describing different physical phenomena, but, and I will come back to this later, may not necessarily like to, they don't look very compatible one with each other, okay? And given that we live in a single universe, you know, abstractly you would want is a single theory that would describe everything. It's not that you would have one theory with a set of principles that describes quantum mechanics and then a different theory with a different set of principles that describes general relativity. That seems awkward because, after all, I mean, quantum mechanics is a theory that describes things that are small. General relativity, roughly speaking, describes things that are very big. You know, but big things are made out of small things, so shouldn't there be a theory that describes everything in one shot? Okay. And that's what string theory attempts to do, which is unify all elementary forces. But this idea of unification has been a goal for mankind from the very beginning. I mean, it is always better to be able to understand things or describe things with a fewer set of words or principles than having to come up with a different explanation for every different little thing, okay? And mankind or humankind has been aiming at doing this since the very beginning. And string theory is kind of at the top of the pyramid in the ambition of trying to come to the ultimate unified picture, okay? So by unification, I mean, let me just give an example that we'll come back to later. It's essentially a way of describing in a single framework two things that before you had the new framework looked like completely different and unrelated. So the simplest example, or one of the examples about this is in the 1800s, people were playing around with charges, and they discovered that there is the notion of electricity. And separately, there was the notion that objects could have magnetic properties. Okay? And these were described, and you might have seen this in the lectures, more mathematically, by an object, E, which is called the electric field. And magnetism is described by an object which is called a magnetic field. Okay. And a simple example of unification, that I'm giving you this an example just to show you where we're going, what kind of ideas we're trying to develop. These theories were unified in the late 1800s by Maxwell into a single theory where the phenomena of electricity and magnetism were combined in one unique framework, okay? And that's called electromagnetism. And where it was understood that, in fact, electricity and magnetism are not separate, but they come in a package, like a bundle of Rogers. I don't know, if you're not Canadian, you don't know what that means. But and that, for example, having electric fields that change with time create magnetic fields, and magnetic fields that change with time create electric fields. Okay, and this was something that was not understood until you had this insight of Maxwell, that these two guys are essentially just two different manifestations of a single unique theory. It's not that there is a theory of electricity and a theory of magnetism. There's a theory of electromagnetism that describes all the other phenomena. Okay. So that's one example of a unified, one crucial unification that happened in physics, as I said, around the 1800s. Okay. And of course, the goal of a unification is that you describe everything that you knew before and more. Usually when there is a new unified framework, you explain things that you knew before, but you also have new predictions. Okay? So when you have unification, you have new predictions. And we'll come back to which predictions electromagnetism made beyond explaining the phenomena that there was separately known for electricity and magnetism. But I think that's crucial from a theoretical perspective is that the new unified theory describes everything else with less and less principles. Okay? So it's kind of simpler and simpler. You get to the bare bones of what's happening. They are simpler principles and more general. More general because they apply to all the phenomena, not just to a single particular one. Okay? So mankind, as I said, has been striving to find a unified description of nature since the very beginning. And just to start somewhere fun, I mean, perhaps the first example of an attempt of a unified theory of the universe goes back to the Greeks. So there was a guy called Empedocles. He lived around 400 before Christ. And the reason I explain this example is because, in some sense, he was very creative in coming up with that this is even possible to do. And as we will see, there are very close analogies. Of course, that you'll see this is kind of a joke of a unified theory, but it has some of the flavor of what you would want a real unified theory to do. So Empedocles essentially said that all matter in the universe is made out of components. And there are four elementary components. He called the four elements. And everything, this piece of chalk, you, me, everything, is made out of, by different, putting different combinations of these four elements. So can someone tell me what these elements are? Fire, water, earth, and air. Okay? So this was his theory of matter. So everything has some fire, everything has some water, everything has some air, and some earth. So what's the matter? But in some sense, you have to remember that this is quite remarkable. At the time, he could, naively, you could have thought, in our daily lives, there is a lot of diversity. So you could have thought that we cannot describe everything just with basic constituents. You might need much more richness to be able to describe everything. But he postulated that with these four elements, you could describe all matter in the universe. But as we know now in physical theories, apart from matter, there are forces acting on matter, okay? And he also proposed the theory of what are the two basic forces of matter. One is an attractive force, and one is a repulsive force. So can someone guess? I don't know, you have to remember that at that time, these people were much more poetic than what we are right now, so think outside the box. So can you imagine what kind of name he gave to an attractive force between two bodies?
Love.
Very good. And what about the repulsive force? Which one? Okay, as far as I know, he called it strife, which is okay, but it's the same idea. Same idea. So attractive force is beautiful, and repulsive force is not so beautiful. And this was his basic theory of nature. As I will try to get during this talk, today we have a similar, but much more, this is not very quantitative, this is just a set of words, and you cannot predict anything with this, you cannot get anywhere. But it has the basic idea. There are basic elements, and these basic elements interact with some forces. And the modern theory of particle physics, elementary particle physics, quantum field theory that I will try to tell you something about, and then string theory, has exactly this structure. It will have a set of basic elements of particles, and it will have a set of basic elementary forces. The big difference will be that we will be able to make concrete or explicit predictions of what is the say the interaction of a set of particles interacting with via some force. Okay, but I think we should give credit to this guy that he really had, I think, an idea way beyond his time, because I think it's rather deep that you could think that you could describe everything just in terms of some very basic, a little bit shallow description, but that you could at least try to attempt to do that, okay? And, okay, so now let's try to move on. And what I'll do is a little bit of not very precise, but hopefully educational tour in history of the various unifications, key unifications that have happened in physics since the beginning, and how this is culminating in string theory, okay? So the first unification can someone guess what was the first unification in physics? Not quite. There was something earlier than that.
The laws on Earth and laws.
Exactly, very good, yeah. So again, the way, and this was done by Newton, and the way he called it is the unification of the celestial with the terrestrial. And that's just a poetic way of saying that the laws that govern the motion of planets out there in the solar system are the same laws that describe the attraction between the apple and the Earth that is falling onto, okay? And this is quite, now it looks kind of a, perhaps maybe trivial, but this is really a very deep statement that there is a set of laws, and they're just universal. It's not that they apply in Ontario and in Spain, there are a different set of laws. You know, there are laws that they apply here in the moon, in the sun, they apply all over the place, okay? Let me go a little bit more deeply in that, to provide an example. I think also something I want to do in this lecture is, apart from telling you about string theory, is what are the new phenomena or new paradigms what happens when you have a new unification. And this will provide us with several interesting examples of how, what happens when you have a new unified picture of some phenomena, okay? So the basic setup for here is Newton's classical mechanics, that's the word. This is a description of elementary bodies that have forces acting on them. So what is the basic equation that tells you, if I give you a body, how to determine the dynamics of that body? So that's Newton's second law, what's called just F equals ma. So you have a body that has a certain mass, and this body is acting on by some force. You will be able to determine the acceleration of that body, and therefore the complete motion of that body. Okay. Perhaps the more useful way of writing this equation is just to write it as a acceleration from which you can determine the whole motion is obtained by knowing the force and the mass of that body. So you have some body that has mass m and has some force. You can calculate the trajectory that this body will follow as a function of time. Okay. And this is the kind of thing that Newton first introduced in a quantitative manner by introducing Newton's law. And what are some of the basic force laws you could have? So F is just a force. Now you have to tell me which kind of force is acting on this body. So let me give you two examples of force laws. One force law, which is kind of universal in many ways, it is the force that describes what happens when you have a system in an equilibrium and you make a small displacement away from equilibrium. The simple example of this is take a spring, a slinky, and have a body attached to it. It's at equilibrium, and now displace it by a certain amount x away from equilibrium. What you want to write down is the force that's acting on this body, okay? And the first example of a force law is that the force grows linearly proportional with the displacement away from equilibrium, okay? And that's called Hooke's law, okay? And in some sense, any system, and that's something that unfortunately we'll not have time to talk about, but any system that's in equilibrium, if you displace it slightly, can only in some sense be described by such a force law, because that's the leading force that you can have near equilibrium, okay? The other law that is more relevant to the unification of the celestial and the terrestrial is Newton's law of universal gravitation. Okay? That essentially describes, this was originally described to describe the motion of the planets. So you have the sun somewhere, and this is the sun, and this is Earth. And what this first law was devised to do is to determine, predict the trajectories of all the various planets in the solar system as a function of time. Okay, this was very important for practical reasons and also for not so practical ones like astrology, but this is something that this has obvious immediate applications. And as you all know, the first law that describes the interaction between the sun and us and the Earth is this Newton's law of gravitation, which tells us that the force is proportional to the square of the distance between the two massive bodies. One will have mass m1, one will have mass m2, and the force is proportional to this constant, which is Newton's constant. It has some particular value that, for the time being, we don't need to worry about, okay? And the thing that's remarkable is that this simple force law, inputted into this general formalism of classical mechanics, where you determine the motion of bodies once you're giving an external force, very beautifully describes the pattern of orbits in the solar system, okay? But the thing that Newton postulated, and that where this connection comes, is that this force also applies to earthly bodies. So by that, he meant that if you are on Earth and you take two massive bodies, M1 and M2, this could be two baseballs, that the force of attraction between these two baseballs is exactly the same one as the one that describes the motion of the planets, okay? So in one shot, he said, and this is probably the first example, that there is a law that applies to essentially all bodies in the universe. Let them be in the solar system or let it be on Earth here, okay? Very good. So it's not that we had to postulate a set of laws for the planets and a set of laws for the apples on Earth. There was a set of law, well, there was a unique law, and that was it, okay? The thing that was also very important from this point of view is that whenever you have a new physical principle, a new law like this one, it immediately explains, like in this example it did, previously empirical laws that people came up with that it seemed like they were coming up from nowhere. They were essentially obtained by extrapolating data and had no really deep explanation for them. And but if you have a new law with a precise dynamical principle, this allows you to derive in one shot these empirical laws. And a nice example of this, so I don't know how much time I probably will not go too deeply into this, but just to mention it in case you've heard of the planetary laws of Kepler. So for example, before Newton there was the Kepler laws, which were empirical. So this guy was amazing. By looking at some data, he was able to come up with three basic laws of planetary motion. Does anyone know what they are? No? Okay. Yeah, okay. So, yeah. So the first one is very simple. Is yes, so planets move in ellipses with the sun at the focus. So an ellipse is something that looks like that. It has two focus points. Here is the sun and here is the planet. And the planet is constrained to move on an ellipse. Does anyone know how you could draw an ellipse with, you know, with basic material that you can find in the kitchen? Exactly. Very good. Yes. Exactly. Very good. So from that definition, we can conclude that one mathematical definition of an ellipse is a curve whose sum of distances from these two foci is a constant. Okay. So that was the first law. The second law you already heard there is that planets, they sweep equal areas in equal times. And this just means that if I have a planet and I wait 24 hours, it will have moved a little bit in the orbit, right? And then you can calculate the area swept, the area under this purple region, okay? Now imagine you wait 24 hours more. The thing that's non-trivial at all, but it's true, is that the area of the first region is the area of the second region. So if you fix the time at which you're gonna measure areas, it's constant as a function of time, okay? And the third one, which is completely esoteric, is you could think, where are these powers coming from? It says that the period of the orbit, namely the time that it takes for the planet to move once around the orbit, which is T, so T is the period of the motion. Exactly. It's proportional to the cubed, what's called the semi-major axis, which roughly speaking is the distance, the longest distance here, okay, A, okay. And this was obtained just from phenomenological, by looking at the data. And one would wonder, okay, this fitted very well the data, but you could always have that, where are these numbers coming from? Why is this 2 and 3 and not 17 and 18, okay? And the thing that once you have a new principle, a new law of nature like Newton's law, he was able to immediately, this is an immediate consequence, immediate that requires knowing calculus, so I'm not gonna do it here, but something that it's, you can derive straightforwardly, given Newton's laws and this gravitational force law, you can immediately derive in one shot all these very phenomenological predictions, okay? So what's the lesson? The lesson is that new unified pictures or new laws explain previous empirical laws and also lead to new predictions, okay? And I'll give you an example of the new predictions, not for here, but for electromagnetism, okay? Any questions about this more general discussion as an example of unification? Okay, good. The separate example, which I already touched upon, which is electromagnetism. So the first example of unification. Is electromagnetism. So around 1850, after the work of many physicists, both theoreticians and experimentalists, it was realized that there are four equations that describe the behavior of electric and magnetic fields as a function of charges and currents, okay? And the basic variables in electromagnetism are the electric field. So this is a function that varies as a function of the three spatial coordinates and time, and likewise the magnetic field, okay? And around this time, what people came up with again, empirical laws that describe the behavior of the electric and magnetic field as a function of what circuit you have, so namely what charges and what currents you had, okay? And I'll write some equations, so this is probably more advanced that you want to know, but I want to write equations just to illustrate the fact, which sometimes, you know, I'm a professional theoretical physicist and I forget how amazing it is that you can write something in the blackboard and it works, and not only works, it makes your blackberry work, it makes everything else work, okay? So I just want to write it down to see that how something very simple actually exactly describes nature, which is incredible to me. So let me write them and I'll try to say a few words. So does anyone know what the name of this law is? So this tells you how this funny symbol, nabla, is actually a gradient. So this tells you how the electric field at two nearby points changes when you put input here some electric source, some like a charge, okay? Well, so this law is called Gauss's law. It tells you how the electric field is determined in terms of the distribution of charges in your system. So the simplest example, if you have a point, an electron, it creates an electric field like that, which, by the way, the electric field also scales like 1/2 as a function of the distance away from the electric field, okay? Just like the Newton's gravitation, law of gravitation, okay? The second law, these are all kind of phenomenological laws, was that this gradient of the magnetic field is zero. This tells us, so actually this equation for some reason doesn't have a name, but physically what it tells you is that there are no magnetic monopoles. So there are no magnetic charges, okay? So we're all familiar with electric charges, an electron has an electric charge, but the fact that the right-hand side is zero is telling you that in nature, there are no objects that carry magnetic charge. But you might think, this is crazy, we have magnets. But magnets don't carry magnetic charge, they carry magnetic dipole, because a magnet looks something like this, but it has a plus N and a minus N, okay? So a magnet is never, globally is not charged, it has charge at the end, but globally is not charged, it's not a magnetic monopole. You could think, why don't I break it here, and then I'll get the plus piece, but if you try to do that, the magnet is smarter than us, and he will break in a way that he will do that. So there are no magnetic monopoles. I have to say that in the more exotic theories that we encounter in string theory and other places, we do have analog of magnetic monopoles. In fact, that is one of the things that I work on understanding the properties in the more unified theories of the presence of magnetic monopoles that are not present in the simpler theories of electromagnetism. The third law tells us how the electric field changes how electric field can be obtained. So again, this is also some special gradients. Just think of the difference between two electric fields between two nearby points. This equation essentially tells us that if you have a magnetic field that varies as a function of time, that it generates an electric field. And this guy is the Faraday law. And the last equation is the analog one for the magnetic field that tells you that the gradient of the magnetic field is proportional to the current. So you have a circuit, you will have current flowing through some wire, and that's called Ampere's law, okay? And this set of laws were fantastically successful at explaining all phenomenological data around this time, okay? But now then came Maxwell around 1850 and made the following observation. He first realized that if you want to take really seriously these equations, that they're internally inconsistent, okay? So if you study these equations and you notice that, for example, the magnetic field appears here and here and here, okay? So you can try to combine these equations and extract consequences. And what he finds is that there was an internal inconsistency, just mathematical inconsistency, like saying that true equals false. Okay, this is ridiculous, so this is garbage. Okay, it's not garbage, it's beautiful, but what did I want to say? Inconsistency. And what Maxwell did is actually fix the inconsistency. He realized, just from a mathematical point of view, that there was one and only one way of fixing up these equations in a way that they were really logically consistent. They wouldn't lead to absurd conclusions. And what he did is just notice that this Ampere law was not quite right, and that just like changing magnetic fields can create electric fields, he realized that changing electric fields can also create magnetic fields. So he added to the right-hand side of this equation this term. Okay. And now, if you add this term to this equation, first of all, now you put really in one package electricity and magnetism, because you realize how changing magnetic fields give you electric fields, but also changing electric fields give you magnetic fields. And this is, once you add this is consistent set of equations, okay? And then he became famous, and he's in all the textbooks and so on. Notice that even though these guys were working for this for many years, the guy that understood it fundamentally and just added one pathetic little term here is the one, is the guy that kept the name of the equation. These are called Maxwell equations now. So if you're going to do it last and do it well. These are Maxwell's equations. And as I said, these equations unified electricity and magnetism into electromagnetism. And now let me point out also an example of what happens when you have a new unification. So first of all, in the setup that these equations before this were valid, namely in the case where you have just what's called magnetostatics, where you don't have this term is zero, you recover the previous equations, okay? That's something that's very important to understand when you build a theory from, I mean, we're born, we have parents, we have grandparents, so physics is also like this. So there's a theory, but before that theory, there was something else that was correct. And if you're gonna try to improve on that theory, and that theory is correct, you better land on the previous theory in the regime of validity of the previous one. Did that make sense? Maybe it's, so, and this is exactly what happened. So electromagnetism reduces to these four laws that without this term in the limit of magnetostatics, but it's more general, okay? And that's what a new theory always does. You describe more phenomena, but if there was a theory that described simpler phenomena in some setting, you better get that from your new theory. You get the original one because that one was correct, okay? And this is exactly what happens here. This is just a very trivial example where in the magnetostatic limit, you recover the original theory. But now, so first of all, you have And I call this the correspondence principle. And this is again the idea that if you have a better theory, this better theory has to describe more things, but it better describes the old things exactly in the way that were described before. And number two, it should make new predictions. So does anyone know what the new prediction of Maxwell's equations are or were? Light, or more generally, waves. Electromagnetic waves. And we all know how important these are nowadays, okay? That move at what speed? And this will be important later. Because whenever you have a new theory, sometimes it gives you a hint of some piece of the puzzle that you're missing, and this was an example of that. The speed of light came out of nowhere in electromagnetism, and we will see that this led to the special theory of relativity, okay? So any questions about this, about kind of this general philosophy? Because I think that's the building block of what we do today. Yes? Well, light is just, electromagnetic waves are just, depend on the wavelength. So a wave has a certain wavelength, and for a certain wavelength, it's light as we can see it. But, I mean, these waves could also be microwaves.
No, I mean, how does he know that the light is electromagnetic in nature, not something else?
I mean, I'm not sure exactly what the question is, but the well, what he showed is that you can have solutions of these equations, provide waves that have a certain wavelength, that carry a very specific set of electric and magnetic fields. You can calculate, for example, the way they disperse in some medium. And, for example, you can pass it through a prism and see, for example, how it breaks into different colors. But I'm not sure that's what you're asking. No? Okay. Can you try again? Let me see if I can understand the question.
What I was asking is, how does he know that electromagnetic waves are light? And how does he know that light is electromagnetic in nature, not, say, light is just a little packet flying through space?
Well, in a way,
you mean visible?
No, any light. Any light, not just visible.
Like, you have this abstract mathematical theory.
Yes.
Of electric and magnetic waves in space.
Yes.
But how do you think that that's light? What's the link to that? Because light doesn't, I look at light, it doesn't look like electric and magnetic waves. How do I link the two? From a mathematical theory of electromagnetic waves.
Well,
you got the speed of light,
and
you equate that to the physical phenomenon of light. How do I identify
those?
How do I know that that's?
Well, okay,
so. He's on the right track. He's saying, if you take these waves, they behave like light. They disperse like light. They travel like light.
Yeah.
How many, you know, all the different solutions to these waves, whatever this electromagnetic wave is, it behaves just like light. So after a while, you got to say.
Yeah. Also, the other way you can see this, you can add polarizers to light, and you can start seeing that by aligning the polarizers in different ways according to where the electromagnetic field is, you can stop the light, for example. But, I mean, usually to go from the theory to these basic things, I'm not completely sure that he immediately said, so he definitely realized that there were solutions of these Maxwell equations that propagated the speed of light, but the fact that I'm not sure he. What do I want to say? Sorry? No, I think he did, but how he knew is a bit. So there is some processing that goes with it. I mean, here just working with some microscopic variables like electric and magnetic fields, and now you want to relate it to our dirty world, and there is some processing there, and. It's just a matter of gathering evidence that this is the right picture. Maybe there is a better explanation, but I cannot think of one now. Okay, so let's move on. Okay, so now let's jump to the 20th century. So that we have the two theoretical structures at that time. And we'll see where this will lead us. So we had classical mechanics. This describes the motion of particles on which forces act. And we had electromagnetism. Now, the first observation is that classical mechanics has a certain symmetry. So something that's very important in physics is to understand what the symmetries of your laws are. And an important symmetry of classical mechanics is something that you might have heard. It's called the Galilean relativity. Okay? Have you heard this word? Okay, very good. Essentially, it tells you how two different observers that are moving with respect to each other describe the same physical phenomena. And the thing that was remarkable about electromagnetism is that if you look at Maxwell's equations, they're not Galilean invariant. They're not invariant under kind of the basic symmetry of matter. So how can this be? I mean, this seems ridiculous. But thinking along these lines is what led to special relativity. So first of all, the thing that was realized quite early on is that this, what looked probably to you like a complicated set of equations, have a deeper symmetry than the Galilean symmetry, which are what are called is Lorentz symmetry, which leads to a special relativity, okay? So this very powerful theory of electromagnetism is not invariant under the symmetries of kind of matter, particle mechanics, but invariant under a different symmetry, okay? And we definitely know that this is a correct physical law. One might wonder, can we fix this up in some way such that it's not invariant under Galilean relativity, but that you find a new set of systems, a new physical law that is invariant under the symmetries that your electromagnetism had, okay? So you want to put together electromagnetism, special relativity, and classical mechanics. Actually, you want to put together classical mechanics and special relativity and see what you get, and that's what led Einstein to relativistic mechanics. Okay? So this is a kind of an example of how the logic in physics sometimes goes. So you get a clue of something new, and then you try to see whether this something new gives you new insights about the in a different framework. So this was for electromagnetism. You wanted to see whether this guy had repercussions for particle mechanics, and it did. This led to relativistic mechanics. And the relevant word here is Einstein, okay? Okay. And the thing to appreciate is that this theory, the classical mechanic theory, the usual classical theory and the relativistic theory behave rather differently. But we know that planets are described still by classical mechanics. So it better be true that relativistic mechanics reduces to classical mechanics when it applies to planets, because we know that the description in terms of planets, that the way we describe planets in terms of classical mechanics. And I'll give you one formula just to show you that in physics, apart from having deep insights, you can see this in the formulas that the explanations that you read are backed up by actual formulas and predictions. That's what makes physics interesting. It's not just words, it's actually predictions. So let me give you an example between the difference of Galilean relativity and special relativity. So imagine you have some body moving with some velocity, and you have two observers. That's me sitting here. That's Richard jumping in. There is no train here, but the train next to the UPI, there is a train. And that train is moving with some with respect to me, with some velocity v, okay? And essentially, if I know, if Richard tells me what his velocity, what the velocity of the guy is with respect to his train, I want to know what the velocity of me sitting here would be, okay? And that, can anyone tell me what the answer would be? Have you seen this? So obviously, if the velocity of this guy with respect to this Richard is v2, what would be the velocity with respect to me? Can one tell me what the relation between these three numbers are? Sorry? Exactly. So it tells you that v1 equals v2 plus v, because v2 was the velocity with respect to Richard, but Richard is moving away from me, so I have to add that extra piece, okay? And that's in Galilean relativity, the addition of velocities, okay? Now imagine that you are in a special relativity. What happens is that the law of addition of velocities changes in a special relativity. And I don't expect you to know this, so let me just write it down. It changes in a very interesting way. So it tells you that square. So notice what I did in the special relativity. That's something that you can derive, and that Einstein did. And that actually, in order to derive this, if you look at his original paper, you need to be very clever, one, but it doesn't require more sophistication than some very basic elementary algebra, but you need to understand exactly what you're doing. And if you look at his paper, he arrives at this formula, where, again, v2 is the velocity with respect to Richard, and v is the velocity of the train, and c is the speed of light, as I said before. And this is in special relativity. Now, let me go back to the case that special relativity should reduce to Galilean relativity if the velocity of this guy and of Richard's train is sufficiently small, much smaller than the speed of light, okay? Because relativity is supposed to be important when you're moving very fast. If you're not moving very fast, you should go back to Galilean relativity. And this is exactly what this equation tells you. So I don't know if it's obvious or not, but if imagine that the velocity v2 is much, much smaller than the speed of light. So you're moving, you're running. And the train is also, that train is very old, so it doesn't go very fast. So much more than the speed of light. You can see immediately from the general formula that applies for any velocity what happens when these two things are true. Essentially, what happens is that if v2 and v are very small, this guy is very, very small, right? 1 plus something very small is essentially 1. So in this limit, you recover exactly the Galilean formula, okay? And this is an example of what I call this correspondence principle, that you have a new theory, it should reduce to the previous theory in the regime in which the previous theory was valid, which was the limit of small velocities. Okay. Also, I'll leave it as a fun exercise to derive from this formula one of the basic properties of a special relativity, which is what? I mean, what is the fundamental property of the speed of light? Is what? So constant means that it's the same for Richard and for me, right? So if light is traveling, it should be the same for me and for him. Can someone come here and see this by looking at the equations? So let's do it. Okay, I'll do it for you. So imagine this is a flashlight, and it's moving at the speed of light with respect to Richard. So let's say that V2 equals C. Well, if Einstein was right, we should be able to see from this equation that since the speed of light is independent of the observer, that I also measure that that light is going at the speed of light. But let's see it in the formula. So Richard tells me that B2 equals C. So now let's plug this in. The velocity that I measure would be C plus V. V is the velocity of the train, divided by 1 plus, now when I see here a V2, I put C. 1 C cancels the C squared here, so I get V over C. And now if you multiply it and divide by C, I don't know if this will be, if it's not obvious, I can go more slowly. If I multiply and divide by C, multiplying and divided by a number doesn't do anything, right? It's just 1. But now I multiply this guy through, so I get C times 1 is C. So in the denominator, I get C. And C times B over C is just B, OK? So I get in the denominator exactly the same thing that I had in the numerator, which is C plus B. So they cancel. So that means that with respect to my frame, I also measure the speed of light, OK? And that's one way of seeing explicitly that the speed of light is the same in all inertial frames, okay? So it's not some story that you read in a book. It comes from the equations of special relativity. Okay, and the moral here was this correspondence principle, that we had a new fancy theory, but when we describe fat planets that move very slowly, we better recover the old laws, okay? So now I have to start accelerating a little bit. So without further ado, I'll just add one more layer of unification. So notice how I said that electromagnetism and Lorentz invariants plus classical mechanics gave us relativistic dynamics. Now you could ask, what is the law of gravitation? Well, at that time, it was still Newton's law of gravitation. So Newton's gravity. But now we discovered that there is a fancier, more fundamental, more general symmetry of the equation, which was a Lorentz transformation or relativistic symmetry. And one might wonder what happens, and this is what led Einstein to general relativity. What happens if you combine Newton's gravity plus relativity? And this arrow, I'm not doing justice to the brilliance that it took to go from putting two and two together to here. But the logic was very clear. So you have a new symmetry. You have an old theory. That old theory was not consistent with that symmetry. Can I find a theory that's consistent with that symmetry? And that's how we arrived at general relativity. But notice that the logical sequence is rather clear. You find something new, and you try to make sure that your laws, what you can generalize your laws to incorporate the good new features that you've learned. And that invariably leads to progress, okay? So that's all I have to say for the time being about general relativity. I saw that some very fancy formulas there before, so I assume that you know everything about general relativity, about black holes and all of that, so I won't say very much about this because I have to move to string theory. But before we move to string theory, we have to come back to the other pillar of theoretical physics. So right now, everything that we've been doing here was classical. Quantum mechanics had yet not been discovered. And around the 1900s, end of 1800s, beginning of the 1900s, physicists realized that physics at very small scales becomes blurry, okay? So you need to get new glasses, that's no problem. But let me just say this in picture. So we already saw that in classical mechanics, if I give you a planet here, you can uniquely determine the trajectory from some beginning, from initial to some final configuration. all that you have to do is you solve F equals ma, or the relativistic version of F equals ma. And this is the orbit. Okay. Now, if you go to something that's very small, so that's in classical, the classical world. In the quantum world, things are fuzzy. So if you start some particle here, first of all, things are not are probabilistic now. So if you ask what is the trajectory of this particle, there is no unique answer. In particular, you could have a trajectory doing something ridiculous like this. And there is a non-zero probability for the particle, say an electron, to move from this point to this point by going around the room and coming back. And you think this is ridiculous. But in fact, quantum mechanics predicts that there is a non-zero probability for this to happen. Okay? And that's the wonder of quantum mechanics. In some sense, in quantum mechanics, anything that can happen will happen, no matter how ridiculous it is. So if I want to go from here to you, there's a non-zero probability that it will go by me going to Pearson Airport and then to Toronto and having a beer with Richard and coming back. It will be very small probability, but it can happen. Okay. So actually, all paths that are allowed or all possibilities are realized in quantum mechanics, and each path contributes with a certain probability. Okay. So this very nice exacting geometry of the classical world is blurred by having this randomness in the paths. Okay. Another way of saying it that you may have seen is that there is an inherent uncertainty in quantum mechanics. So let me not go through this very carefully, but I'm sure you've seen this. Like Heisenberg uncertainty principle that tells you there's a certain fuzziness in trying to localize basic observables that you usually see in classical mechanics, like velocity, sorry, position and velocity, roughly speaking. There is an inherent fuzziness which is measured by this new constant of nature. So it's just like in going from classical mechanics, from Galilean mechanics to relativistic mechanics, we introduce a new constant of nature, C, which is the speed of light. In going from the classical world to the quantum world, we introduce a new constant of nature, H, which is the Planck constant. Okay? That in some sense measures the fuzziness of our very small system. Okay. Okay. So now that I introduce this, let me draw the following picture, which I think might be useful. So I'll do it here. So now let's try to summarize what we've learned. So we want to understand which physical theories apply in which regime of validity. Okay. So let's call this axis moving to a smaller distances. And this axis increasing speed, so high speeds. So here, this will be low velocity, this will be high velocity. Okay. And we want to know a given physical system as a function of how small it is and how it is described by which system, okay, by which physical theory. More rigorously, the way you would define this is that the basic quantity that determines in where you are is essentially the velocity of your system divided by the speed of light. And here, it's measured in terms of the new units that you introduced. So the new unit in relativity is the speed of light. And in quantum mechanics, the new unit is h bar. So all of you have an intuition of what velocity is. Here, there's an analog, which is called action or angular momentum. So I'm not sure how much intuition you have, but there is a definite quantity that you can measure. And you want to compare as a function of h bar. Okay. If that number is very large, you're very classical. If the number is very small, you're in the deep quantum regime. Okay. So now, in formulas, essentially, there are four windows. Of course, the division line here is a bit artificial, because if you're moving at 0.5 the speed of light, you're neither classical nor fully relativistic. So this is just to develop an intuition about the asymptotic regimes of very small and very large parameters. Okay, so if we're moving at, if we're at very large distances, like planets, and we're moving at very high speed, at very low speeds, right, down here, we would describe this by classical mechanics, non-relativistic classical mechanics. If now we start moving with higher velocity, and we're still at very large distances, then we have to replace classical mechanics at high speed. I already said that this is replaced by relativity, relativistic mechanics. Okay? So as you increase the speed, you have to replace Galilean relativity by special relativity and classical mechanics by relativistic mechanics. Likewise, if you go from a large system and you zoom to a very small system, I already argued here that we have to go from the classical world to the quantum world. So here you have to go to quantum mechanics. So the question is, what is this? Okay. Now you could ask, okay, imagine I have a quantum system, but this quantum system, something very small, but it's moving very close to the speed of light. How do I describe this? Well, this cannot be quite correct because quantum mechanics has symmetries of Galilean relativity, not of a special relativity. So how do I describe a system that is at the same time very small and moving very fast? An example of this is the kind of system that you get when you're at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva and you collide protons. These protons are very small. The constituents of the protons are very, very small. They're moving almost at the speed of light. So how do you describe them? This theory is clearly inadequate because this only applies to small velocities. And that's where the next unification happens. And essentially what you... And we're using the same strategy all over again. So we had a new symmetry, which was relativity. We have a new theory, which is quantum mechanics. So we want to ask what happens in this corner. So we want to ask what happens when you try to construct a system that is quantum theory plus relativity, special relativity. And people investigated this in the 20s and 30s. And what you end up is with the framework, which is called quantum field theory. Or I'll call it QFT, quantum field theory, OK? And again, quantum field theory has the requested correspondence principle that any new, more fundamental theory should have. It reduces to quantum mechanics in the limit of small velocities. It reproduces relativistic mechanics when quantum effects are negligible. And when both are negligible, you recover classical mechanics. Okay? So you have a new theory that has definitely many new predictions. Quantum field theory has many new predictions, like the existence of antiparticles. So for every particle that you know, quantum field theory predicts that there is an antiparticle that has exactly the same property, the same mass, but has different charge. For example, quantum field theory, just as an abstract theoretical framework, just like Maxwell predicted the existence of electromagnetic waves, quantum field theory, in one shot, predicts the existence of antiparticles. And lo and behold, X number of years later, after Dirac noticed this, these antiparticles were measured. Okay? And this goes back to the logic, correspondence principle and new predictions, and if you're lucky, you test the predictions with experiments. And that's where string theory has not been so lucky yet. Okay, this framework is fantastic, okay? I cannot emphasize how this theoretical framework essentially describes every single process in the universe, okay? It describes an immensely large set of physical phenomena with a degree of accuracy that makes your mind blow. I mean, you can predict things to 11 decimal points, okay? 11 decimal points is really a lot of points, okay? It's really incredible precision. And again, this, I just want to offer a second, how is it possible that by writing some equations on the blackboard, you can actually not only describe the universe, but make such accurate predictions. But this is kind of the wonder of science, that you can actually do this, okay? So in this framework of quantum field theory, now we go back to Empedocles, 2,000 years later. What are the building blocks of matter and the elementary forces in nature? So there are, let's start with the forces. And these forces are described by a relativistic quantum field theory. And these are the kind of theories that make predictions for accelerators, for example, also for tabletop experiments, okay? So the basic forces, non-gravitational forces, is the electromagnetic force. I'll tell you what the ingredients are, or what are the particles. And I'll tell you what the force carriers are. So essentially, when you have two particles and they interact with some force, the way they interact with each other is by exchanging a force carrier, okay? So things interact because you exchange particles between them. It's like sending a messenger between the particles, okay? So what are the basic particles that interact electromagnetically? Can someone tell me? Photons. Okay, photons would be more like the force carrier. But anything that carries a charge, so an electron or positron. See, in some sense, the photon does not carry electromagnetic charge, but the photon is the one that's responsible that if you scatter, you want to scatter two electrons, they feel each other's presence by exchanging a photon. Okay, this wavy line is supposed to be a photon. Okay, which it's called a mu for some technical reason. Okay. By the way, these basic particles can be acted by more than one force. Okay, so an electron carries electromagnetic charge, but also carries charge under what's called the weak nuclear force, which is responsible for radioactive decay. How the neutron decays into the proton, plus an electron, plus a neutrino, okay? These are electromagnetic forces you are kind of familiar with on an everyday life. You put the fingers in the wrong place. Weak nuclear force, hopefully you're not so familiar with in a daily life, but it's a very important force. And the basic particles, again, can be the electron, the positron, but there are new characters like the neutrino, the neutron, whatever. And here the basic force carriers are some very fancy particles that are called the W bosons and the Z. I don't know if you've heard of these particles before, but these are just in the same way that electrons interact with each other by exchanging photons. The particles that enter a radioactive decay interact with each other by exchanging these particles, okay? And the last one is the strong nuclear force. And this is the force that is responsible for keeping the nucleus together, okay? Notice that the nucleus, so something I should say is that, well, the strong nuclear force keeps the nucleus together. The nucleus, in particular, has protons in it. But this is yet another example of how by digging deeper and deeper, we see that things that we thought had a particular structure, if you look deeper, they have a yet more structure. Protons, as you might have heard, are made out of quarks. Okay? By three quarks. And the strong nuclear force, even though the quarks carry electric charge, so if you have two charges with the same charge, they repel each other. So you might think, how is it possible that these guys don't fly apart? You have, at a very short distance, three charges with the same charge. They should just fly away. And what happens is that the strong nuclear force, that's why it's called strong, despite this electric repulsion, keeps all these guys together, kind of by some tube, okay? And the guy that put it together has the an imaginative name or gluons. So the gluons are the particles that are responsible for holding the quarks in the proton together, okay? And all this theory, okay, so this is Empedocles 2,000 years later. This is it. Okay, this, there is gravity. We'll come back to gravity later, okay? These two theories are also unified in what's called the electroweak theory. And there have been Nobel Prizes awarded, by the way, to each of these forces, several Nobel Prizes, because these are monumental discoveries for mankind. And this combined picture is called by the really boring name of the standard model of particle physics. They should have been more like Empedocles and find something more beautiful to say, but they didn't. Because it's really a very modest name for all that it does. This essentially describes all experiments that we can do, okay? And is the most predictive theory in nature. Okay, so now we could stop here and just pat ourselves in the back and say, okay, this is fantastic, we're very smart. But what, there's a problem here, right? The problem is that this guy, I didn't include it here. So what's happening here? So in the last few minutes, I'll just try to motivate string theory and how it tries to go beyond this picture where these forces and gravity are separated into a framework where all of them are together and they live happily ever after. Or maybe they won't, but for the time being, they do. So the basic problem is that if you try to put together quantum field theory plus general relativity, which are the two basic pillars, right? So this essentially describes everything that has to do with particles and reduces to everything we know in some limit. And general relativity, so this in some sense describes the very small, this in some sense describes the very large, like the expansion of the universe. As I said before, I mean, since something very big is made out of something very small, by small things, it should be possible to make sense of these two things. But the thing that's being the most, or one of the most important puzzles in theoretical physics, kind of at the boundary of, you know, there are theoretical physicists that deal with data every day, and there are theoretical physicists that try to come up with new ideas, new principles. And for those kind of people, this has been the most important puzzle since the 50s. Namely, the fact that if you put together quantum field theory and general relativity together, you get an inconsistency. A bit like how you took the four electromagnetic equations, you put them together, you get an inconsistency. Something is missing here, okay? And this is a clue. Whenever there is an inconsistency, we get very happy because it's a clue that there is some gold somewhere. And if you're lucky and smart enough, you might be able to find it. That's one problem with this fantastic picture. The other problem, which is more of a technical problem, is that these quantum field theories that describe all these experiments come with a large number of parameters. So these theories have a certain number of parameters that you don't know where they come from, and you have to fit them. So before you can make any prediction, you have to fix the number of these parameters by comparing them to experiments. So in the standard model, you have, roughly speaking, 20 parameters. So you have to make 20 independent experiments to fix the value of those parameters. And then any experiment that you do you beyond that is a prediction of the theory, an ambiguous prediction. But first, you have to fit the 20 parameters. Okay? And this is kind of distasteful, I find. You would want, I mean, if you want to, really, let's be ambitious, what the hell. And you really want a theory that will have no free parameters. It will tell you why the parameters are the way they are measured to be. And so too many parameters which are fixed by experiment. But I want to emphasize that even though now I'm kind of pooping on this is amazing that you fit the parameters and then you have millions of other experiments that you can do that test the theory. you make predictions and then you test them. But you first have to fix these parameters that, from the point of view of your field theory, have no clear origin, okay? So you want to find a framework that solves these two problems. Well, you would be happy if you solve one, either one. And what I want to now tell you is that string theory, in some sense, solves one and two. Definitely does one. Definitely it gives you a theory that not only marries happily quantum field theory and general relativity, but even more strongly, the theory makes sense if and only if gravity is included. Okay? So it's a theory that makes sense only if the thing that was very difficult to make sense of is consistently put there with quantum mechanics. Okay? On top of that, and that's icing on the cake, a string theory does not have any parameters. This is amazing. So in some sense, all the parameters that you would recover that you have in quantum field theory are determined by the dynamics of string theory. Okay? That is kind of the ultimate dream that you would want for a unified theory. It will describe all forces, including gravity, which was impossible before, and it will have no parameters. So we'll just say, well, in an ideal world, we just make a sharp prediction and get it over with, okay? It doesn't quite work like that yet, but that's the ambition, okay? Okay, so how does it do it? Let me just tell you a few words about string theory. Can I go over, like, 5 minutes? So in quantum field theory, we had this long, actually it's much longer than this, but you have a long list of particles that you put there. And you think of them as having no structure. Okay, so you have a particle that has no structure and you represent it by a point. Okay, and to each point we associate a different particle, the electron, the muon, W bosons, so on and so forth. Okay. And in quantum field theory, once you give me the particles, you have to prescribe what are the different interactions that these particles can interact with. And you have to give me pictures like this that tell you, for example, what happens when an electron scatters off a photon to give you another electron. Well, you have to postulate what kind of interactions can the different particles have. And this is captured by the different interactions that your quantum theory will have, okay? And again, this gives you parameters that associated to this, there is a probability amplitude, let's call it lambda, or G, for this process to happen. This is a parameter of the theory that you have to fit with experiment and then make predictions, okay? But what we've learned over and over in the history of science is that whenever we think we understand something at some fundamental level, if you look deeper, you find some new structure. So, for example, just a kind of a trivial example. I mean, historically, well, there was an atom, okay? By looking deeper, always by zooming at shorter and shorter distances, you find that the atom is actually has a nucleus. So if you zoom in, it has a nucleus. If you continue this process and you zoom in the nucleus, you find the picture I had before, where actually you find that the proton, so say you have a proton in the nucleus. The proton for many, many, many years, it was thought to be a fundamental object. Namely, it had no internal structure. It doesn't make sense to us what it is made of because it's just fundamental, it's a fundamental object. But by probing using accelerators, distances much smaller than the size of the nucleus, it was found that actually the nucleus is made out of quarks. Okay? So a lesson that we've seen is that by going to more fundamental length scales, you discover new structures that you didn't know were there before. Okay? And the basic postulate of string theory is to do this once again, in some sense. So here I drew the basic building blocks of nature, the elementary particles, as points. But you could wonder whether these points, if I really go to a very short distance, have some internal structure. And that's exactly what string theory postulates. So string theory postulates that if you're able to resolve these basic particles at very, very short distances, they're not point-like at all. But they have an extended nature. They have a structure. So essentially, the basic postulate of string theory is that you replace a particle by a very small loop of string. Okay, this loop can be either open or closed. It can be a rubber band, or you can cut the rubber band. You can have what I call closed or open strings. This is a detail that will not matter. And the thing that's amazing about string theory is that here, the list of particles that made out of a universe is just like a shopping list. Okay, you have electron and blah, blah, blah. It's kind of a list that you have to write down. But string theory makes the following unification, okay? It tells you that all the different particles in the list are made out of the same stuff, okay? So there is some stuff, which is this string. It's kind of a little thin, infinitesimally thin tube of energy. And all the different particles are just built out of this basic gunk, okay? And let me give you an analogy of what this means. So just like you have a guitar string, you can pluck it in different ways and get different harmonics. So you could have a string that has no note, or you could have a string that has one note, and this gives rise to different harmonics. But it's the same string. The same string is giving you different harmonics, but it's made of the same object. Okay? It just depends on how you hit it. The idea of string theory is that all these guys, all these elementary, so-called elementary particles, are in fact not elementary. They're made out of the string, but they're made out of the same type of string. That means that just like one note is one particular configuration of the string, and another one is a different one, the electron corresponds to a particular. You have a string, it can oscillate in different ways. So the electron will correspond to this particular oscillation, while, for example, the photon would be a much wavier one, okay? In this way, all the different particles in nature are just different configurations of the same string. So there is a basic building block, which is the string, and all the different particles are just different harmonics, if you wish, for that string. Okay, and that describes for you that's this unification we're having. Okay, that you don't have to postulate a different field, if you wish, for each particle. The string has all of them in it in one shot. Okay, everything is made out of the same stuff. The other thing that happens is that interactions are purely geometric. So how do things interact? How do strings interact? So you could have a string that splits in two. Okay? So far what we're missing, remember that in my description of quantum field theory, we had the kind of the basic particles and the force carriers. But the thing that's remarkable about string theory is that the force carriers are made also of the same type of string. So if you want to describe a process where you throw in, so first of all, something I should say is that just like particles generate a line as they propagate in time, you have a closed loop of string, and you propagate it in time, will generate a tube, okay? So in order to describe interactions, you actually have to split these tubes in different ways, okay? So if you want to describe the string theory analog of this electron-electron scattering process, exchanged by a photon here. The interaction is made always. So here I had different wavy lines that I had to draw. Here, the whole process is made out of the same string. Okay. Remember that this guy that is being exchanged between the electrons is exactly the force carrier. So this tells you that not only this idea of string theory tells you that not only that all the matter particles are different oscillations of the string, but also the force carriers are also different excitations of the string. Because this guy is no different than this external guy, which was an electron. Okay. So in a way, string theory unifies a matter and interactions. They're all part of the same picture. Okay. The thing, and with that, I'll probably conclude. The thing that's fantastic about string theory, and that definitely was not put in at all, it didn't have to happen. It was, in fact, a surprise, and people for many years thought that the string theory was wrong because of this phenomenon, which I'll tell you now. So if you study in detail what this theory predicts, or some of these basic predictions, what you find is that it does exactly what you would hope that it does. String theory predicts gravity. It's there. Even if you want it or not, it's there. There is no way of getting rid of it. But this is great, because this is exactly what we were looking for. We were looking for a theory that was able to describe not only the interaction between particles under the non-gravitational forces, but also included gravity. And this is exactly what string theory does. It predicts gravity. It includes the forces between elementary particles. Okay? Which is exactly what we wanted. Good. So I should probably start concluding. So in this picture, what we found is that hopefully I convinced you that even though it requires a certain kind of insight or even genius to make a fundamental breakthrough in a new layer of understanding of physics, there is a good recipe of how to do it. The good recipe is to improve your theories always respecting, it's like your with your elders. You should always respect your elders. So new theories should respect previous theories, and they should make new predictions. And if you follow that logic, you discover new theories. This happened with electromagnetism, it happened with special relativity, it happened with quantum mechanics. In some sense, it's happening with string theory. And now, string theory, as I said at the very beginning, is a theory that we're just starting to grapple with. This is, in some sense, it's an incredibly rich theory. In order to describe it, you're going to just open a math book and learn the math that was done before. In order to think about string theory, you have to invent new math. It means that we don't really yet have the right language or the right formalism to describing it. And I think, as I said, we're still just trying to put together the different bits and pieces of what this theory are. But with our current understanding already, it makes truly remarkable unifications. I just gave you kind of a very sexy example of it. But I think it's work in progress. And maybe, how old are you guys, 18? So in 10 years, one of you, or even less, will take us from our current picture where we just understand bits of pieces of the theory. Maybe one of you will stand up higher and see the whole beast and tell us how to really think about string theory. So thank you very much. I need to send an email to. I don't have my email. I'll be saying one way. I don't have a big one.
Yeah, okay.